How can we explain the pro-Israel biases within media that is supposed to be balanced? Are Israel's genocide of Gazans necessary to prevent a Holocaust of Israelis? Does a man truly wishing to end Canadian capitalism, militarism, and imperialism have a realistic chance of becoming the new leader of the New Democratic Party of Canada, or does he have other motives for running? Why is the country's most left-wing competitive political organization embracing NATO and its foreign policy agenda as its own? This week on the Global Research News Hour, we have a special episode dealing with the principal concerns of Canada's leading critic of its foreign policy, Eve Engler. We discuss the subject of the Israel bias in mainstream Canadian media, and we also discuss Eve's decision to run seriously for the New Democratic Party leadership after its former leader resigned. We will also hear part of an interview from 2018 with Eve by Global Research NewsHour collaborator and friend Paul Graham. On this week's program, prominent foreign affairs critic to lead the NDP, a conversation with Eve Engler. Bringing you the analysis beyond the media headlines, the Global Research NewsHour is on the air. Welcome to the Global Research News Hour for the week of July 18th, 2025. The program is funded by the Center for Research on Globalization and produced in collaboration with Campus Community Radio Station CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg. I'm your host, Michael Welch. The show seeks to provide listeners with access to analysis of some of the major issues shaping our world today from thinkers, researchers, and unique political personalities rarely addressed by major media. Our program is available to partner radio stations across Canada and the United States and available for streaming or download at the site globalresearch.ca. We acknowledge that the program was produced on the traditional territory of the Anishinaabe, the Innu, the Ojibwe, the Dene, and the Dakota, the homeland and heartland of the Métis Nation. Every day we attempt to restore balance to the unjustly procured assets of the land and waters obtained by settlers from the Indigenous peoples, and through reparations and reconciliation, attempt to pursue new paths built on partnership between two peoples moving forward. Now it's time for News Notes, a sampling of articles from the Global Research News site. Listeners should know that some of the articles may run against common messaging about sensitive subjects and are not all endorsed by this radio station. On July 15th, Financial Times published a report claiming that U.S. President Donald Trump reportedly demanded that the Zelensky government escalate its long-range strikes on Russia. He allegedly even told the Kiev regime frontman Volodymyr Zelensky to attack Moscow and St. Petersburg and that Washington, D.C. would provide the weapons. FT cited, quote, two people briefed on the discussions, unquote. The conversation reportedly took place on July 4th and came just a day after a quote-unquote disappointing call with President Vladimir Putin. If true, this could signal yet another instance of Trump's increasingly aggressive stance on Russia. That comes from the article, Trump allegedly demanded Zelensky hit Moscow after a quote-unquote disappointing Putin call, by Drago Bosnick, posted July 17th, originally published on InfoBricks. Putin currently represents a more moderate and cautious approach. However, the delivery of long-range missiles to Ukraine might provoke a harder line from the Kremlin. Trump presented himself in his election campaign as the man of peace who would end military conflicts. But this new leak from the Financial Times shows the opposite. He encourages Ukraine to escalate heavily, even toward attacks on Moscow. If these plans become reality, we will enter an extremely dangerous phase of the war. That comes from the article, Trump asked Zelensky if he could strike Moscow, by Mark Van de Piet, posted July 17th. 1. The major problem appears to be collusion between the seed companies and the regulatory and research establishment in India, leading to detrimental effects on farmer welfare, e.g. hybrid cotton, GMO BT hybrid cotton, suboptimal low planting densities, low yields, and suicides due. 2. Hybrid cotton is extremely expensive and unique to India, leading to suboptimal planting densities due to high seed costs. Hybrid cotton was implemented with false promises of increased quality and yield, and while fertile, the saved hybrid cotton seed produces highly variable cotton, and hence the seed is not replanted. That comes from the article, BT Cotton in India is a Monumental Catastrophic Failure, by Colin Todd Hunter, posted July 16th. According to public opinion surveys, when Macron mentioned sending forces to Ukraine, he did not receive support from more than 10% of French citizens. He is an alienated representative of the global centers of power, who does not have support for his policies in France. It is sure that after him, a completely different policy will come, one that traditionally treats Russia as a close country. After all, in economic terms, Russia provides the most important metal and non-metal ores, semi-finished products, and energy for the French economy. The German economy is also suffering without cooperation with Russia, and Chancellor Merz's statements should be taken with a grain of salt. That comes from the article, Europe doesn't have strength to send troops to Ukraine despite Macron's ambitions, by Ahmed Adel, posted July 16th. These are just a few of the featured articles appearing last week on the Global Research website. Regular visitors to the site are encouraged to send monetary contributions by fax, mail, or online. Just go to globalresearch.ca and click Donate on the menu bar. Continuing on with a discussion of last week's conversation about the ongoing media suppression in Canada of the Israeli genocide in Gaza, we got a few points of view from Eve Engler, the leading critic of Canadian foreign policy in Canada. He's authored 13 books. He's also currently active trying to mobilize opposition to Canada's support for the Israeli genocide and opposition to Canada's membership in NATO. I spoke to Eve last week. Here he is on the Global Research NewsHour. Could you just mention a couple of examples that come to your mind about the, outrageous bias against the Palestinians and pro the Zionist Israel?
Well, the bias is through and through, of course, in the coverage. At the extreme end, if you look at the National Post, which I read every day, they make it seem like Israel is the victim and Palestinians are the ones perpetrating the Holocaust. And their chief editor takes funded trips to Israel, and Roberts is his name, and is open about the fact that wealthy pro-Israel Canadians bring him there, and he celebrates that his brother goes along with him on the trip. So it's totally in your face. They don't even try to hide really the fact that they are basically doing propaganda for the Israeli government. Now at the more liberal end of the media, be the the CBC, Toronto Star, there's been with the CBC there's been quite a few stories that have detailed people inside who've written about how there's the Palestine exception and how much difficulty they have in getting guests that have a what would be called a pro-Palestinian perspective, or maybe just properly called as a believers in international law, and how those voices get blocked at every turn from appearing. So it's it's all through the media sphere, and there's lots of reasons for why the media is so biased against the Palestinian perspective. But, you know, at this point, it's actually quite well documented. There's a new book that's just come out called When Genocide Wasn't News, and it's a compilation of stories, articles about the past 20 months of Israeli slaughter and how the media is biased, and it looks at it all kinds of different angles of, you know, what words are used in the Globe and Mail to describe October 7th versus what words are used to describe a couple hundred thousand people killed. And, you know, they use much more aggressive words on the CBC or in the Globe and Mail about what Hamas did on October 7th than they do about what the apartheid state, you know, 80-year-old apartheid state has done in its genocidal campaign. So, you know, there's so many examples, it's hard to, you know, just sort of pin to one. But the other part I think that's important for a particular Canadian audience is not just that the media is still serves the Israeli government perspective, but that it very much denies Canada's complicity in the genocide. Like they'll sometimes mention that, you know, Canada has some arms sales to Israel, but the scope of Canadian assistance to Israel currently and historically, that is just ignored. I mean, it's just ignored unless it's done in a celebratory way. So there can be stories, maybe a bit less recently, but in recent years, about Canadians fighting in Israeli military, and it would be like some young Calgary kid who's joined the Israeli military, and sort of, oh, the family and excited and this, and sort of positive. I'm referring to a CBC story from a few years ago, but they will never do that same story from an international law perspective or from a genocide perspective, in that young Canadian kids are going to kill Palestinians in Gaza. And that's just one example, but it goes all the way through the whole question of registered charities. The fact that we, you know, devote towards $500 million in taxpayer subsidized donations to Israel every year, that's and the fact that some of them support the Israeli military, West Bank settlements, racist organizations, which all contravenes Canada Revenue Agency rules for registered charities, that the media just won't cover that. Even though we put out many press releases, we've been many campaigns, there's almost no dominant media or corporate media attention in this issue. So even the half of Canadians who now believe that Israel's committing genocide, they have no sense of just how complicit Canada is, and not just how complicit, but how unique this support for Israel is. I mean, Canada's foreign policy is pro-imperialistic, pro-US, pro-corporate all around the world, but it is a fundamentally unique dynamic with Israel, where we are just so many unique ways in which we assist Israel that we don't do with any other country.
I'm thinking of an example of Heather Reisman, who's the head of the Indigo, trying to recruit people to the Israeli army. UN legal experts are saying it's a potential genocide, and there's not much awareness that's what this organization is doing. And yet, you know, how do you see the approach to the activists who are you know, trying to, you know, raise awareness of this in the eyes of people in the major media?
Well, I think there's two sides to that. The first thing, the important side, is that they've basically ignored the demonstrations. So in Montreal, which I know well, I've been to the demonstrations most weekends for the past 21 months, and the media covered a little bit of the demonstrations early on. In the first 5 weeks of demonstrations in the Holocaust in Gaza, the media covered some of the demonstrations. A lot of it was really negative. They made a huge controversy over a speech that was in Arabic, and they missed it was, you know, pro-Israel groups mistranslated it, and so there's a whole bunch of it was negative attention. And then after about 6 weeks of demonstrations each weekend, major demonstrations, I mean, like thousands and thousands, tens, 50,000 was the biggest one. They continued to be 1,000+ people demonstrating every weekend for the next year. And literally, there was no media attention all the way until the encampments, I guess it was about 7 months, all the way until the McGill encampment. And then the media covered that because it kind of came via the U.S. and the whole controversy in the U.S. So they basically just ignored the demonstrations for like 7 months, even though, you know, thousands of people were taking the street downtown, you know, which is something kind of unique. A demonstration that size should get some attention in the corporate media. So that's the one side. And then there's a, you know, huge amount of the attention that they do cover is like, oh, well, they protested in front of a synagogue, and they'll just, you know, quote like these pro-Israel forces in Montreal saying, oh, it's protest in front of the synagogue, but they won't mention, and literally this happened in Montreal, that they just don't mention the fact that there was like an Israeli soldier speaking at the synagogue, and they just tried to frame it as it's like one night, you know, people decided they were going to have a protest in front of the synagogue. It was like there's no reason, and I mean, which is just egregious media manipulation. So there's that, you know, this sort of either ignoring and or when covering it from this sort of this totally pro-Israel perspective, smearing the protesters. Again, like these, we are talking about all the major human rights organizations and scholars have all concluded this is a genocide, and they concluded this a long time ago, and those who are opposing that are being presented as this like, you know, negative, horrible kind of whatever. And the world flipped upside down. Of course, it's those who are, you know, what should be happening is that there shouldn't even need to be a protest, and people, there should be stories in the paper about how a synagogue is bringing in somebody who's just participated in the genocide, and how wild it is that an institution in Montreal would want to be promoting someone who is, you know, participating in a slaughter campaign. That's how the media should cover this. That's how, you know, an international law focused media or a basic humanist media would cover it. But instead, it's those who are, you know, defending internationalism, defending basic human rights, are the ones who are, you know, the scary, dangerous, threatening mob.
Who would you identify as some of the major players in instigating this kind of treatment? Globe and Mail, Toronto Star, National Post, of course, then CBC. Like, it's all across the media, and I'm wondering if there are particular players at work, and their tentacles have reached into all of these newsrooms, because that's just, it's enormous how this continues to play.
Yeah, I mean, I did the 2016 book, A Propaganda System, How Canada's Government, Corporations, Media, and Academia Sell War and Exploitation. And the basic point of the book was to look at how the media particularly, but the broader intelligentsia, you want to call it, or information sphere, was biased in favor of power on the foreign policy front. So it's across, it's not just with the Palestine question. If you look at the coverage of Canada's role in Haiti, you'll find that it's a pro-Washington, pro-Ottawa perspective that gets covered. On Palestine, I'd say it's uniquely bad in a number of different ways, partly that the history is so clear-cut and detailed. I mean, the Palestinians are the victims, and Israel came and stole the land of the indigenous people, and that's just not, there's no, that's just the facts, and now that country that's done that is committing a live stream Holocaust in, you know, 2025, that we can all watch the, you know, incineration of children and women and civilians trying to get food because they're starving. I mean, it's not, it's just totally in our face. And so the media, obviously, they all have access to the same social media platforms that we have access to. It's not like they don't know what's going on. It's unique on Palestine, and there's a number of reasons for that. I mean, I've detailed, you know, there's ownership, you know, the Post Media, right? It's the son of the founder of Post Media, Paul Godfrey, his son, you know, he was the chair of the Walk for Israel that just took place in Toronto. I guess it's a few months ago now. So, Paul Godfrey he created Post Media, which is the biggest media conglomerate in the country, the newspaper-wise, from the ashes of Can West. Well, Can West was the Asper family, and when the Asper family established Can West, they were really clear. They imposed this really aggressive pro-Israel editorial and news perspective. And it's not like the media that they purchased were like, you know, pro-Palestinian media before that, but they just took it to a whole new level of explicit. And they it led to like, you know, a publisher being driven out, resigning at the Montreal Gazette. It led to Reuters complaining that their wire copy was changed in an anti-Palestinian way. This is all like well documented. It's just clear cut. And the Aspers were pretty open about it themselves. So that has obviously an impact on the whole media sphere. More generally, you know, the Honest Reporting Canada, and it's a really effective FLAC organization, pro-Israel FLAC organization. And part of its effectiveness is because it's tied into a whole institutional pro-Israel structure, obviously CIJA being the most important, and the Jewish Federations, which, you know, have billions of dollars in assets. And a more broadly well-organized, well-financed pro-Israel lobby, and also I should say that have, you know, ties to a powerful and wealthy powerful figures like the lead donor for the liberals is Stephen Bronfman, and so tied into a whole broader power structure. But then on top of all that, and of course this is all connected into the U.S. empire and other ideologies of settler colonialism and Christian Zionism. And but then on top of that, you have this kind of special stick that's, I would say, there's no other media disciplining dynamic as effective as the whole anti-Semitism stick. And so Honest Reporting Canada, when they come at the media outlets that may say Palestinians are human beings, and they come at them hard, which they do, they have all this power structure behind them, and they have this ideological stick of like, oh, you're only doing this because you're anti-Jewish, or oh, you're portraying Canadian Jews poorly, or whatever variation of how they use that. And so it's a you know, there's real history behind it. It's not just all a made up stick, of course, but in its political effect on Palestine, it acts as just this disciplining stick for the media, the sort of broader intelligentsia, and it's utilized very effectively. It's totally cynical, of course. You're using, you know, a history of genocide to justify and enable an ongoing genocide. And actually, just to give an example of, you know, when the to give one side of the stick in use is that the when the Holocaust monument in Ottawa was defaced, it's about a month ago, 6 weeks ago, whenever it was exactly, the spokesperson for the Holocaust monument in Ottawa came out and used the occasion in the Globe and Mail to say this is we have to stop funding UNRWA. And that connecting, like, the, you know, Canada funding UNRWA, the UN agency for Palestinian refugees, that this was enabling Hamas was enabling these like terrorist supporters in Canada who defaced. That was his basic logic, and so he's basically saying we're going to use this moment of media attention around our monument, supposedly about human rights, the history of the Nazi Holocaust, to use that to put pressure on the government to not fund, you know, to participate in the starvation campaign against Palestinians in Gaza. I mean, it's the cynicism of it is remarkable, but it works, unfortunately. And so that, I think, is obviously, you know, just to explain the media bias is a, you know, book level endeavor, but there are many facets to it, and it's quite intense.
It's not that you're necessarily mocking the memorial, but this bit of graffiti is being used to elicit opposition to a group that's feeding people. You know, there's no relation between the two things, right?
Exactly. I go one step further with there's been a conscious, when I talk about the anti-Semitism stick, Finkelstein documented this back in 2000 when in his book, The Holocaust Industry, and he shows how there was, you know, conscious effort after the 67 war, where Israel served an important geopolitical use to the U.S. in smashing pan-Arabism, Arab nationalism, which, you know, threatened U.S. control of the region, that there is a just a huge explosion of museums, books, whatever, about the Nazis' destruction of European Jewry. And that this was being done with pro-Israel or Zionistic intents. And what happened when Finkelstein, which he was clearly correct in documenting back in 2000, that dynamic he documented has become 10 times worse today. To the point, again, where, you know, here in Montreal, the Holocaust Museum, the officials from that are openly supportive of Israel's Holocaust in Gaza. I mean, they don't hide it anymore. The Holocaust monument in Ottawa, this official was using this opportunity to justify the starvation of Palestinians in Gaza. And there's a whole institutional, in the sense of the Holocaust Museum specifically, but broader ideological edifice that has been consciously built up by proponents of Zionism to serve as a justification in one sense for Israel, but I would say beyond that, as a disciplining stick, and talking about in the media sphere, as a disciplining ideology, let's say, against those who, you know, challenge what Israel's doing. And, you know, the most, you know, Erwin Kotler establishing a special envoy to combat anti-Semitism and Holocaust remembrance, which he convinced Trudeau to do back in 2000. He was the first envoy. And now you have Deborah Lyons in that position, and she's just open advocate of Israel's genocide in Gaza. I mean, Deborah Lyons, when she was Canada's ambassador in Israel, she had in January of 2020, she had a pizza party for Canadians fighting in the Israeli military. I mean, no, why would the Canadian ambassador have a party for Canadians fighting in any country's military, let alone a military engaged in a, you know, brutal, illegal occupation of more than 50 years? And so these positions are not being just sort of set up like, oh, we care about human rights, we care about the history of the Nazis' destruction of European Jewry. These institutions, these positions are being set up with clear political aims, and how that plays out in the media sphere is to just intimidate, to scare people, from journalists, reporters, whatever, from you know, saying that Israel is committing genocide, and it also gives liberal-minded, sort of liberal journalists, they frame their genocidal mania from the lens of like, oh, we were concerned about anti-Semitism. That's a common tactic and a common dynamic, maybe should I say, in the media. You see, you know, these sort of pro-environmental, I'm thinking this Allison Haynes at the Montreal Gazette, is sort of pro-environmental kind of journalist. And over the past 21 months, she's written a bunch of pieces that aren't like necessarily pro-Israel in a direct sense. They are basically, there's a real danger of anti-Semitism and the history of the Nazi Holocaust, real danger of anti-Semitism. And basically these people protesting Israeli soldiers at synagogues are a threat. So she are dangerous, or they're fitting the long history of whatever. So she doesn't come out and say, I support Israel in any sense or directly. She just basically plays to the whole ideological sort of pseudo human rights kind of framing of like, oh, the Nazi Holocaust was horrible. Obviously it was horrible. But you know, using that, using the memory of those, you know, incinerated by the Nazis to then justify doing that to Palestinians. I mean, that just makes the horrible history even more horrible in its, mm-hmm. In its effect. So this is how lots of liberal journalists effectively be pro-genocide, is not directly, but in an indirect sense. And that's enabled by this whole, what Finkelstein referred to as the Holocaust industry.
You're listening to the Global Research News Hour, broadcasting from CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg and from partnering radio stations across Canada and the United States. You know, there's another thing that I think you've got to comment on is the existence of it calls itself a charity, and that's Honest Reporting Canada, which essentially they get all their membership, and they think they got like 60,000 people engaged. You know, they point out something that they say is anti-Semitic or you know, misrepresents the situation in Israel or whatever, and they write to the journalist, and they write to the managers, and they inform them that it's wrong. I mean, then journalists, I mean, they have the ability to defend what they're doing, right? But it seems to be having a real effect. And I mean, I remember one example of a woman who was working, was a black woman working for CTV News for 14 years. She was covering Wet'suwet'en. And but the thing is, one of the indigenous activists was wearing a keffiyeh. And they weren't even talking about Israel, but they used this as a justification to to really clamp down on her. And I mean, she, in a nutshell, she ended up leaving. But it just goes to show the levels to which these people will go. And I'm wondering, I mean, are you aware of any of Honest Reporting Canada? Have they influenced you or people close to you in any way?
Well, obviously they're effective, but I do want to make that I stated their effectiveness is partly because they are tied into a whole institutional power structure that also has this ideological stick that they get to play to. In terms of Honest Reporting Canada and the media's sort of response to Honest Reporting Canada, I mean, I had the only time my book Canada and Israel Building Apartheid was reviewed. It was in 2010 when it came out. David Heap, who's a professor at the Western University, he reviewed the book for the London Free Press, and he reviewed it positively. He's obviously somebody who's supportive. So a review appeared. A week or 2 weeks later, there was a counter review. It's almost like I don't know if I've ever seen a counter review of a book review in the paper. And it was basically Honest Reporting Canada doing a counter review of how bad my book was and saying that how dare somebody who opposes apartheid be able to review this book in the paper, even though he had pretty solid credentials as a professor at the local university and fairly decent credentials for a local paper, and they had a counter review. So I mean, yes, Honest Reporting Canada of course targeted me many times. I think at this point they mostly what they'll do with me is they'll target, if rabble.ca publishes something I write, they'll target Rabble, because they'll target the publication, because a lot of the publications get some government grants of some sort, or they'll some connection to a source of leverage that Honest Reporting Canada has. So they don't really kind of respond to me anymore because they know it's not much effect, but they try to sort of like pressure the publication to not publish stuff I write. And so they do this, do it in various levels. Now, Honest Reporting Canada is remarkable. I mean, they'll write reviews or write criticisms or action alerts to the Concordia student paper, right? So there'll be some story in the Concordia link paper, and they'll have a whole email campaign against the editor of this small little student paper. So their willingness to sort of go after all outlets is quite remarkable. But again, I think their effectiveness is, yes, they are a registered charity. It's outrageous that all taxpayers are subsidizing them. But their effectiveness is not because these editors necessarily listen to 1,000 people emailing or 500 people emailing about some story, but that they know they're part of a broader power structure that goes right up to the U.S. empire, supporting Israel, right, or down to the fact that here in Montreal you have Combined Jewish Appeals, big federation that's will sometimes pressure the Montreal Gazette or other media publication alongside Honest Reporting Canada.
From Israel-Gaza media coverage to running to lead the new Democratic Party of Canada, Yves, with his thorough scholarship and his personal devotion to Canadian foreign policy, from Israel-Palestine to Haiti to Ukraine-Russia to Venezuela, the Socialist Caucus of the New Democratic Party chose the young activist to run to lead the party, easily the most left-wing party in the House of Commons. Yves spoke to media about plans to lead the NDP on Monday, July 7th. Eve has never run for office before and has persistently been a bit of a pest to all the partisan politicians, so a run for office may seem daunting. Intrigued and fascinated, I chose to bring up this leadership bid and where it may take him and the party. Are you running basically to actually win? I mean, is that you have a realistic chance, or is it more an opportunity to get these the truths, or you know what you see is true in the wider mass medium, and not just little community radio stations like mine, but get a broad audience? Because if you had enough support, you'd be able to reach you. I think the media would have no choice but to talk to you. You know, what is your real main motive, I should ask?
Yeah, I mean, I'm not leading the race, and I don't have any pretense to the fact that I'm leading the race. I'm running principally to impact the discussion and to move the discussion to the left. I think that's the realistic success in this campaign. I'm not just running for that. I am running to win. I don't expect that my odds are, you know, are they 1 in 1,000 or they 1 in 10,000? I don't know. They're not an impossibility. I don't believe that. I do believe it is a possibility. I do believe there are tens and tens of thousands of Canadians who are appalled by Canada's complicity in the Holocaust in Gaza, who know that I first understand the issues well, and that I have the credibility to be, you know, to actually stand up and to be bold and to not, you know, cower in the face of pushback. The other issue, a big picture issue that I'm running because of my initial reaction after being asked by Socialist Caucus was to be, you know, no, I hadn't even thought of it. And then I was like, thought about it for a few weeks, and I was like, But the issue that really got me, the second issue after Palestine that got me going, is this, the military spending. And in many ways, even more, I'm even better placed than the other people in the NDP circles on this issue, which is that basically we're seeing the greatest transfer of wealth from welfare programs, from social programs, to the military in certainly since at least before, basically since World War II, maybe the Korean War, but 70 years. And we're basically going along with just totally wild NATO military commitments. And the NDP is not in a position to oppose this because the NDP has basically supported NATO. They, you know, Heather McPherson, the leadership lead, you know, candidate, she's on the NATO Parliamentary Association. She sits on it. One of two NDP MPs on that group. She has come out in favor of NATO, expressed support for NATO. She's, you know, even called for Ukraine to join NATO. Even while Jean Chrétien is saying that, you know, NATO was central to provoking the Russian invasion, which I've criticized, you know, considered contrary to international law, but NATO is central in creating the conditions of that. And yet you have the NDP foreign critic coming out in favor of this, you know, serious escalation of affairs. So they the NDP has, and you can see that with the statement they put out about the 5% of GDP on defense that the Carney has committed to. It's a wishy-washy statement that sort of says we're against it, but then complains that other parties haven't fulfilled their NATO commitments. I mean, it's a remarkable statement in the context of huge cuts to social programs that are going to come as a result of this. And it's the best case scenario is that this huge, you know, $1 trillion on military addition over the past decade or in the next decade, that the best case scenario is just a big transfer of wealth away from social programs to the military. And that it bolsters a you know, racist, authoritarian, sexist institution. That's the best case scenario. The worst case scenario is that it does that, and the monsters, the Mark Carneys and the Pierre Poilievres, who've been overseeing support for this Holocaust in Gaza, that it gives them more resources, more people in uniform, more soldiers, more weapons to go and commit more acts of belligerence and aggression internationally. That's what, you know, the likely outcome of a huge military boost is. And so I think that I have unique knowledge on both the Palestine and the military question. I, of course, published a book on Standing Guard for Whom, People's History of the Canadian Military, and a willingness to state it as it is and to be bold, to be direct on these issues. So I think I can add some pretty important subjects to the race. Now, it's much broader. Obviously, you know, I'm putting forward we need to move away from capitalism. We need to be building economic democracy. I'm calling for a right of way. I'm going to come out with many more detailed program, of course, but calling for the tar sands need to be quickly phased out. I guarantee you that's not what others, certainly Heather McPherson in Edmonton, is not going to be calling for. So I'm, you know, pushing land back, going to be pushing, you know, real decolonization. So I'm going to be raising issues that haven't been, aren't being discussed for the most part. So that, I think, is the likely, you know, there's the realistic success is to influence the debate, but I am running with the intent of winning.
So just one more thing is that, I mean, your friend, Alex Terrell, the leader of the Green Party of Quebec, I tend to think the two of you are two peas in a pod in terms of foreign policy. And he ran for the leadership of the federal Green Party, but he was not allowed. They prevented him, you know, in the party. I think the reason was that because of his position on Ukraine, saying it was a NATO proxy war as opposed to all Russian invasion or something like that, which was not the Green Party position. So I mean, does it make sense to assume that they'll do the same thing to you, that you won't even be allowed to run, because you're saying a lot of things that, you know, are so against the mainstream that you know, even the NDP would consider you acceptable, unacceptable.
Yeah, they're going to try to block the candidacy, of course, through the high threshold of financial. So you have to raise the minimum is going to be 50,000, but now somewhere between 50 and 100 looks like what they're going to. So that's a way of blocking all grassroots candidates. There's going to be some vetting process, and they may or very likely will try to block my candidacy that way. Before that, there's ways of trying to not have that happen, which of course I will do, and in a public sense, not in denying things I've said in the past sense, but in a political campaigning sense. So you know, I'm at this point, we're not asking people to become members to vote for me, because at this point we, you know, we don't know what's going to happen, but we are asking people to check out the website for NDP leader. Not much there. Check out my website. You know, we're gathering, you know, people who are supportive and you know, their emails and stuff. So we're going to if I do pass the vetting process, we can, you know, start the formal process of that. But yes, we are expecting there will be efforts to try to block my candidacy, but also trying to begin putting pressure on the other possible candidates to say, hey, we want an open and honest debate about these issues. We want the different voices. Don't you know, block people just because they say Canada should pull out of NATO, you know, that kind of stuff as well.
Okay, Yves. Well, you've been very generous with your time. I appreciate your hanging in there, but we'll leave you now. Thank you so much for being a participant in this discussion, and I guess best wishes in the upcoming race.
Thanks a lot.
You've been speaking. Take care, Mike. Okay, take care. We've been speaking to Yves Engler, activist, author, and now leadership contender for the NDP. He spoke to us from Montreal. Yves Engler was born in Vancouver in 1979, the son of union activists who were involved in international solidarity, feminist, anti-racist, peace, and other progressive movements. In the early 2000s, he became focused on anti-corporate globalization organizing. He got voted in as vice president of the Concordia Student Union and helped to block Benjamin Netanyahu from speaking at the university to protest Israel's war crimes and anti-Palestinian racism. Yves ended up being expelled from Concordia University for his alleged role in starting what the administration described as a riot. Yves went on to organize massive anti-war demonstrations against the war in Iraq, but it was after Ottawa helped execute violent anti-democratic policies in Haiti that he started to question Canadian foreign policy, starting in a book co-written with Anthony Felton called Canada in Haiti, Waging War Against the Poor Majority, and helped establish the Canada-Haiti Action Network. In later years, he would author many books, including The Black Book of Canadian Foreign Policy, followed by Canada and Israel, Building Apartheid, Canada in Africa, 300 Years of Aid and Exploitation, A Propaganda System, How Government, Corporations, Media, and Academia Sell War and Exploitation, Left, Right, Marching to the Beat of Imperial Canada, Stand on Guard for Whom? A People's History of the Canadian Military, and his most recent, Canada's Long Fight Against Democracy, co-written with Owen Schalk. The NDP Socialist Caucus Chair, Barry Wiseleader, claims that, quote, Eve Engler is exactly the leader Canada's NDP needs, fearless, principled, and unapologetically socialist. He represents everything we stand for, workers' rights, democracy, peace, and environmental justice. We call on all NDP members who believe the party must return to its democratic socialist roots to support Eve Engler in this leadership race, unquote. To finish off this program, we resurrect part of an old interview from October 2018. It was conducted by Global Research NewsHour collaborator and friend Paul Graham. It talks about the book Left Right, Marching to the Beat of Imperial Canada, in which he directly describes what he sees wrong with the NDP and the left generally in Canada, and ways we can overcome the smokescreen blinding us to our country's own foreign policy. So here now is that conversation.
Well, two things jumped out at me when I was reading your account of the NDP and the CCF through the years that you alluded to. One of them was there's, on some things anyway, there seemed to be a division between the leadership of the party and the rank and file, or at least, you know, important parts of the rank and file over foreign policy questions. And I guess the other thing that struck me is the profound impact of the Cold War, anti-communism, and so on. Do you want to amplify on any of that?
Yeah, I think the division question between the leadership and the membership is a very important question. There's many facets to that. One, you go right back to, you know, the CCF supporting the Korean War. That was done in a way just before the convention taking place up in Vancouver in 1950, and it was done explicitly. The Executive Council came out before the convention, just before the convention, and stated very strongly, we support the war and we want ground troops. And there was anger among members who wanted to actually debate the issue. Same thing with NATO. It's more complicated in that there was constant debates at conventions over NATO, with the leadership consistently backing NATO and the membership bringing that up at convention after convention, and finally, not till in the late 1960s, they're able to actually get a sort of partial victory on the question of calling for Canada to pull out of NATO. That's a battle you see that goes on till today, right? You had the most recent convention on the question of Palestine. There was a huge groundswell behind this fairly moderate Palestine resolution. More than 25 riding associations have backed it. The youth convention unanimously backed it. Many different NDP affiliated groups backing this resolution, and the leadership blocked it from even being discussed by the convention. They pulled all kinds of shenanigans to make it so that this resolution, that was the most widely supported foreign policy resolution, couldn't even be discussed at the convention. And that's this kind of perspective that has been, I think, the overwhelming dominant perspective within the party leadership, which is basically to keep the activist opinion on foreign policy issues marginalized. The mere matter of debating these issues is viewed as sort of embarrassing to the party leadership when it comes to the dominant media. And so they do what they can to try to just make it difficult to even have discussions of these issues. So that's a very important part of the whole question of NDP, CCF, foreign policy. And a sort of element of that is also the fact that this is not, you know, there is lots of ignorance within the, you know, membership of the party on different foreign policy questions. There's no doubt that the lack of knowledge about, you know, what's going on in Venezuela today, for instance, is a problem within the party. But at the upper echelons of the party, the problem is not just ignorance. I mean, they actively try to suppress discussion and debate on these issues, and there's a whole history that I detail in the book of these efforts of trying to sort of suppress debate, which like I said, it shows that the leadership is has made their decision not based upon not knowing stuff, but based upon certain political calculations, and I think those political calculations are heavily driven by, you know, what's considered acceptable by the dominant media.
So you've proposed a partial solution to that that you call the Canadian Foreign Policy Institute. You want to talk about that for a bit?
Yeah, I mean, I think the one thing I want to just say before getting into that. This book, my most recent book, is sort of a part two of my previous book, which was called A Propaganda System: How Canada's Government, Corporations, Media, and Academia Sell War and Exploitation. And as I mentioned at the start of Left Right, that previous book answers 90% of the question of why we're so confused about Canada's role in the world. So it looks at the dominant media, the military, academic institutions, you know, funded by corporations, funded by the military, and how they have distorted the foreign policy discussion. This book is really just 10% left over, which is how the left has not put up a challenge to the dominant sort of propaganda institutions of Canadian foreign policy. So that's one thing I want to say, which you sort of alluded to in your previous comment. Now, in terms of the how do we counteract both the dominant foreign policy propaganda institutions, the media, you know, the military is the biggest public relations entity in this country. You know, it has hundreds and hundreds of full-time employees trying to convince us that they're doing good stuff or convince us of their perspective of the world. So how do we combat that? Now, I think that the main way we combat it is through the activism, the solidarity activism, the anti-war activism that is taking place by magnifying, amplifying what's already going on. There's you know, peace groups in most cities in the country. Many of them are largely dormant. Some of them are a bit more active than others. It's about, you know, making those groups more active. There have been times in Canadian history where there has been a lot of activism on some of these issues. The most probably successful example was in the lead up to the 2003 war on Iraq, where the anti-war movements were able to at least have Canada not officially join the George Bush administration's coalition of the willing that invaded Iraq. Canada did still support the war in different ways, but the biggest, most important thing we're able to stop. So there are instances where the anti-war movements or the, you know, the mining solidarity movements, which have had some successes, you know, fighting against what Canadian mining companies are doing in Guatemala or elsewhere and trying to bring in restrictions on Canadian government support for those mining companies. So there is that activism exists. So the main thing that needs to happen is to amplify that activism. One of our problems is it's not all the anti-war movements of the 60s against Vietnam, the Central America Solidarity, South Africa, even Palestine, for the most part, it's very difficult to institutionalize it. It's had an impact on the political culture. There has been this effect on political culture by all this activism. I would argue that we actually are more internationalist today and less racist than we were 1,500 years ago. And we have sort of those movements have been able to constrain how the Canadian military fights. So they're still brutal, but they're not as brutal as they were during the Korean War, for instance. So that activism, and the activism sort of has been institutionalized in a certain way in some left-wing media, but it's very difficult to sustain the organizations. Now, what I'm proposing in the Canadian Foreign Policy Institute at the initial phase, and people can go check it out online today at foreignpolicy.ca, initial phase is just an effort to bring together critical information about Canadian foreign policy. So all the best articles, podcasts, whatnot, dealing with Canadian foreign policy, from a critical perspective. There's a list of the best books on Canadian foreign policy. There's a couple dozen books listed on the website of dealing with different elements of Canadian foreign policy. So an initial phase is just basically a sort of repository of critical information about Canadian foreign policy. Now, with time, and if there's resources that are found and developed, the sky's the limit. But there's a need or there's a potential for doing some elements of what a traditional think tank does of producing reports with the intention of trying to have those reports picked up by the dominant media. There's a possibility of setting up chapters in different cities across the country. There's a speakers bureau of different individuals. That one of the things that I'm working on setting up different individuals who are sort of experts, if you like, on Canada Saudi relations, or the people who are experts from a critical perspective on Canada's role in Haiti, and offering those individuals both to media and to activist groups looking for a speaker to deal with whatever issue. So there's many facets to what the institute could be. Initially, it's just a repository of critical information on Canadian foreign policy. And over the years, hopefully, it will be an entity that can provide a platform to many of the different activist groups taking on specific elements of Canadian foreign policy, and also have some sort of help in sort of consciousness raising in terms of people seeing Canadian foreign policy from a multi-faceted perspective, that there is a connection between Canada's warmongering abroad and Canadian mining companies being powerful players. There's a connection between Canada overthrowing or trying to overthrow an elected government and Canadian companies being major international investors. So part of the objective of the Foreign Policy Institute is to amplify the work that the different activist groups are doing, but also to provide, a bit bigger picture of Canadian foreign policy.
For more on Eve Engler's bid to run for the leadership of the NDP, please visit the site yvesforndpleader.ca. That was our show for this week. Tune in for our summer broadcasts over the next month. You've been listening to the Global Research News Hour. You can listen to our programs every week on CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg and on partnering radio stations across Canada and the United States. You can also download each episode from the website globalresearch.ca. To leave feedback on this program, email globalresearchnewshour@gmail.com. I'm series host, creator, and producer Michael Welch. Join us again next week.